Episode 168 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world manage risk and seize opportunities. Learn more at futuresfundamentals.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey, everybody. Before we get started today, I want to thank our sponsors, CME Group, Trading Technologies, and Top Step Trader. Now today I spoke with Keith McCullough, founder and CEO of Hedgeye Risk Management. Today Keith and I discussed the importance of traders using both fundamental and technical analysis. Keith tells us when and why he became bullish on U.S. equities and why he thinks the stock market still has room to run. He explains why traders should look at market positioning and how to use the VIX and other volatility measurements. We chatted about U.S. growth and inflation and how it's impacting the market. He explains why valuation is not a catalyst. Finally, Keith tells us his thoughts on passive investing, the flattening of the yield curves, and he gives us a catalyst to watch for possible trades in 2018. As usual, thank you all for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Keith, welcome to the show.
Anthony, thanks for having me.
Great to speak with you today, Keith. Now, we have a lot to discuss today about the markets, but before we do that, tell us how you got your start in the industry.
Well, it's like any, college athlete. I got recruited to come to Wall Street. Didn't know what I was doing, but went to Credit Suisse, First Boston, where I was on the rotation or on the program. And then I, hopefully after a year of that, I went to a hedge fund called Dawson Sandberg, which eventually became Pequot Capital, which was a pretty big hedge fund back in the day. In the year 2000-2001 is when I was over that wave, and that's where I became a hedge fund analyst, I guess, and that was the beginning of my career.
So you talked about you were an athlete. What sport were you playing?
I was a hockey player.
Nice. Well, to me, hockey's the best sport going right now. I think the NFL is used to be my favorite, but I'm a Blackhawks fan, so I've been pretty much all hockey for the past several years. But it's amazing to me on how so many athletes end up getting involved in financial markets. Tell me about that moment when you decided to go over to Credit Suisse.
It was a pretty humbling time. I'm sure many people would agree. I mean, for me, my career in hockey was my goal. I hadn't really thought about doing anything else, really. But once I jumped onto a trading floor, and there were some similar characteristics in terms of just the sense of urgency and the competitive nature. And if you're not going to play, and get on the ice and get your teeth knocked out, you might as well do some version of that without the teeth part on the floor, or at least somewhere where you could have a competitive bid ask. And that's where it got me really interested in it. And then finally, it was whether it's a good or bad thing, it was the money. I mean, my father was a firefighter, 38 years in the fire department, and here's Wall Street in 1999 offering me effectively, what my dad was making, which I thought was absurd and, be beyond absurd for me not to accept.
Yeah, it's similar to me. It was the excitement, and then I saw people making a lot of money, and that obviously drove it. But then, like I think most traders in this industry, you fall in love with markets because, like you said, it is a challenge day in and day out. And I'm a competitive guy myself, and it's never easy, Keith. It's a challenge every single day. So talk to us about your current role right now at Hedgeye.
Well, I guess I'm still the CEO and founder until somebody removes me from my seat. So that's my title. I'm sticking to it. Started the firm in 2008 in the middle of the crisis. I guess our claim to fame was that we were bearish. I'd recently left Carlyle, where I was a portfolio manager running their first hedge fund. And that's where I've really been since 08. So every day at the top of the risk management morning, you can find me on Twitter at some ungodly hour. Just working through what I think the market is looking like to me, and that's what I really do throughout the day, as I serve as a market strategist, economist, et cetera.
Okay, so let's talk about strategy. And I'm up at those hours too, and you and I have even had some back and forths on Twitter talking about markets at that 4:30, 5 a.m. time. Now, let's talk about what your style is. I've seen you put up charts. I've seen you talk fundamentals. What percentage of your strategy is fundamental versus technical?
I don't know if there's a percentage. I mean, I definitely subscribe to being, I guess I call it multi-factor and multi-duration. So I look at multiple different things across multiple time horizons, because I think you can really, if I go back to everything that I believe, it's largely a function of all the mistakes I've ever made. And being one-dimensional can really be a big problem. So, I mean, when I talk about being quantamental or having a fundamental research view combined with my quantitative research, that's what I really do. And I can't really say that one overrides the other or one is a fixed percentage of the other. It provides me with the overall lens, if you will, and the ability to focus on all of it, I think, at the same time. And I think that the most important thing when you're doing both fundamental research, and I have 40 people on my research team, so I'm, you know, from my perspective, if you're going to claim to do fundamental research, you should have a team that can really backstop you on that, because it's a really tough job and you do need the breadth and depth of experience. But once you have that done and you're looking at the market signals, again, I'm very much a man of doing what the market's telling me to do as opposed to telling the market what to do.
You've been bullish on U.S. equities. You don't hide behind that. It's probably the hockey guy in you comes out, and you are you're definitely someone who doesn't hold back in his thoughts. And you've been bullish on U.S. equities, but I want to go back to the moment when you became bullish, and I want to understand if that was a fundamental technical reason or combination.
Well, back then, I mean, it was November, it was a year ago, and back then was both. I mean, really, when I get loud, I have to have both the fundamental and the quantitative view. When they both line up, of course, you know, if you have a process that includes both, then that should give you a lot of conviction. I mean, if you don't have both, or you only have one of the two, then I don't think that I would be loud at all. And some of that, to be clear, is just marketing. I mean, that we do have to get noticed. We are still the little guy on the block, and we feel like when we have a view, we should certainly make that clear. And I think I made it really clear. I mean, if you go back to, some people thought it was the election, it was not. What actually happened was the October retail sales data had accelerated. You got that data in November, and that was really the last of a series of what I call trending research data points that took the GDP growth trajectory from negative to positive. So in other words, if you're looking at a sine curve, you know, GDP growth had bottomed in Q2 of 2016 and started to accelerate, you know, albeit modestly, in Q3 of 2016. So by Q4, to me, it was quite obvious that not only were we accelerating from a U.S. economic perspective and profit perspective, but we were accelerating from a place where a lot of people were negative and a lot of people were really looking at it politically as opposed to quantitatively and economically. And that's really, you know, where I think I try to make the most noise is when I have the economic and the quantitative signals working in kind.
You know, I agree with that, because I am someone who is primarily a technical trader, but when I see fundamental reasons that agree with, coincide with my technical analysis, I trade much more aggressively, because that has given me the reasons that I really am looking for, to say, hey, there's just too many things for me not to step in and put risk on. And when I have them contradicting each other, I tend to just, you know, trade a little bit smaller. And I want to go back to you being bullish on U.S. equities, and we talk about how you still believe that there is room to run. Explain to us right now what you're seeing that gives you the reasoning to think that U.S. equities still can go higher.
Well, for me, I mean, there's two big components to our fundamental research process. One is growth and one is inflation. And the way that I model it is in rate of change terms, or in second derivative terms. So again, that puts me, you know, all loudness or tweets aside, it does put me in the land of speaking factually. You know, it's not about inflation or growth being good or bad. You know, that's an opinion. It's about whether it's getting better or worse sequentially and year over year. So that's not an opinion. That's a fact. And that's really, you know, what I'm really focused on. And I do appreciate that, you know, a guy like you is looking for, you know, confirmation to enhance your sizing or your conviction, because that's precisely what I'm trying to do, is give people a 3 to 6 month head start on that. So what I'm trying to do is say, hey, look, this data is trending. And by the way, if I look forward at where we were last year, you know, the comparisons, for example, get easier. So the probability is that in the next 3 to 6 months, you're going to see even better economic data. So we've been saying that, you know, pretty much for a year now. And the reason why I've stayed in U.S. equities or the NASDAQ in particular is that I didn't see the peak of either the profit cycle or the GDP growth cycle until at least right now, you know, which is the fourth quarter and maybe the first. And that's really the debate that I have in my mind now, is not what level is the market at. Again, I don't care what the level of the market is. I care about whether the data is getting better or worse. And to me, it's still an open question if the data is as good as it gets in the fourth quarter or it could continue in the first quarter. And that's what makes me data dependent and grinding every morning, I guess, like I have to do.
Yep. And I want to go back and talk about how you mentioned that I look for analysis, fundamental analysis, to help support my technical trading. And I think that for all the futures traders out there listening, I get a lot of questions of people asking me, Anthony, you say you trade technically and you have a strategy, but then you talk about fundamentals. Well, yeah, because I want to know the theme of the market. So I'll look at what Keith says, and Keith's like, okay, look, this is what's happening on a macro point of view. Now, I'm not trading the same time frame or even in the same way as Keith. I'm using futures, but I like to know what the macro look is, because if guys like you, Keith, are bullish and you feel that there's, like you said, you're not really looking at the price of what a level is in S&P, but you're looking at what's happening to give you reasons to remain bullish of the market. Mm-hmm. So when the market pulls back, you look at that as an opportunity, because your theme is like, okay, this is an opportunity now. And I feel the same way as a technical trader, where it's like, if I see the trend is up and there's the fundamental picture behind me that says you should be buying these dips, well then guess what? I trade my longs more aggressively and my shorts less aggressively. I mean, that's the whole point of, you know, managing risk.
That's a great way to do it. I mean, and I think that a lot of people, and me included, I mean, again, I'm purely a birth child, some knucklehead hockey player who learned the hard way enough times what not to do in the market. So, I mean, you know, what I do today is certainly not what I would have been doing 15, 20, 20 plus years ago, because I'd have no idea what I was doing. I was guessing. I mean, I was, you know, just playing on adrenaline, I suppose, and being competitive, and maybe that helped day to day, but it certainly didn't, you know, help me do what I do now, which is, you want to make good decisions like within what I call the risk range of the market. So if it's a bull market and you have the fundamental research view to, again, complement that, you're darn right you're going to be buying aggressively when the market corrects to the low end of the range. So then you can be selling at the top end of the range. I mean, if you only go back to last week, I mean, the VIX goes up to 14 and change, and people are losing their minds. Meanwhile, you could just be buying everything that you like, and moreover, buying everything that you've liked for 12 months. So, and it worked again, and it worked for the right reasons again. So again, you know, durable goods growth accelerates to 6.5% on Friday. That's a 37-month high. CapEx is up 8% year over year, and GDP is going to come out this week with a 3 handle. And to me, that's what I've learned, is that I can mitigate, you know, my losses by not buying high and buying at the low end of the range, so then I don't have to be the guy chasing after the move. And that's, to me, that's a really important part of trying to navigate, you know, what is obviously a market that's gone a long way in a short period of time, but it's one that you could stay with, and if you have stayed with it, you've made a lot of money.
Now, we talk about buying opportunities. Now, Keith, even me as a futures trader, man, there's been so little to do. It feels like these pullbacks are so tight. What do you make of these small pullbacks that we are getting?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with market positioning. I mean, when I look at the market, I don't just look at the price. I look at the price, the volume, and the volatility of the market. So if I look at my core three-factor quantitative signal, if you will, that's what I'm looking at. So if you really study volatility, what you have right now is a bearish trend in volatility. And, you know, that bearish trend in volatility, to your point, has perpetuated this very shallow correcting environment, this very, you know, kind of like mundane thing that's lulled a lot of people to sleep. But at the same time, if you look at the market's positioning, and what I spend a lot of time measuring and mapping is really CFTC futures and options contracts. If you look at the net positions, long or short, non-commercial, so again, looking at where Wall Street is actually positioned as opposed to qualitatively saying, you know, qualitatively, anyone can tell you if they're bullish or bearish. What I really care about is where the market's positioned. And what you've noticed really in the last 3 to 6 months is that the net positioning in the NASDAQ fully loaded has been quite bearish relative to kind of the move that we've had, and volatility continues to be your friend. In other words, volatility is trending bearish, so the price of the NASDAQ is trending bullish, and the net positioning is too bearish. So, you know, for me, like when we see that net positioning, the net long positioning mount to something that's greater than two standard deviations of where it's been, then I might say, okay, this is completely frothy. But we haven't had that. That's why I think we've had such a nice backdrop of shallow corrections.
Can you give us a little bit more detail on what you are looking at when you say that the NASDAQ has bearish positioning?
Well, if you look at the net positioning, CFTC futures and options contracts, you look at the net long positioning. Currently, I think it's about 28,000 net long contracts, and that's quite small relative to itself. So, in other words, I measure that in Z-score terms, and I'm not trying to geek out here, but I mean, where is the position relative to where it's been? And that's like a minus 1.5 times on a one-year Z-score basis. So in other words, you know, the average 6 to 12 month position in the NASDAQ net long position is a lot more than 28,000 net long contracts. So what actually happened is that the net long position has come down as the market's gone up, because everyone and their brother, I think, is trying to call the top. I mean, we have, I'm sure you've noticed, we have basically too many cartoons for top callers at this point. You know, it's a dying breed, but again, you know, when people are trying to call the top, they're not getting bigger on pullbacks. They continue to hedge, and I think that you can see that. People, again, are hedging every correction as opposed to buying the damn dip, which they should have been doing.
Now, you also mentioned the VIX. Now, I used to watch the VIX a lot, and maybe it's just me, but I feel like the VIX is broken. It doesn't help me as much as it used to. Talk to me about what you are looking at when you are looking at the VIX.
I don't just stare. I mean, the VIX to me is just one volatility measurement on one macro index. What I look at when I think about volatility is I look at realized, especially in the 30-day window. I basically have all of macro, and I look at it from an ETF perspective. Where is everything on a 30-day realized basis versus 30-day implied? And then I'm measuring where those implied volatility premiums or discounts are moving and where they move from. And the key to that really is constantly, like, I'm big on writing it down. So if I write it down, I'm deliberately studying the market. I'm observing it. I'm measuring it. I'm mapping it. It takes me away from telling the market what it should be doing. Oh, this feels wrong, or whatever it feels like. It shouldn't feel like anything. It should be telling you what it's doing, which is, in volatility space, it's really instructive to know when, say, an implied volatility premium, a massive one, let's say in the NASDAQ, which only a week ago was about 100% versus 30-day realized, huge implied volatility premium, collapses to a 5% implied volatility discount. Okay, now, with the market at the all-time high, now I can sell some longs on that. So what I'm constantly looking at is volatility space in those terms relative to the market's price.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that there's growth and inflation right now. So tell us what you think that means for the market going forward, and what markets do you see the best opportunities?
Well, growth, we always had a back-end loaded view to GDP growth. And my view on GDP growth isn't some, you know, kind of economist view. I do have an economics degree, but whatever. We run a predictive tracking algorithm. I mean, that's what modern day macro people should be doing, is that they should be letting the data tell you where GDP is going to come in. And if you could have known that GDP would have two consecutive threes in front of it in Q2 and Q3, you would have been confident to write what I write every morning, which is hashtag U.S. growth accelerating. And that's really the point. So, you know, on growth accelerating, we really don't have anything to say that GDP growth is not going to accelerate through the back half of the year. Obviously, we're getting close. We have maybe 5 or 6 weeks left in the year, so that's an easier thing to say now. I think a better question will be, at what point in 2018 does that happen? I think that the most likely point is when we cycle, you know, the best of or the toughest comparisons, which is really starts in April. So that's what I'm thinking there. On inflation, you know, this move in oil clearly has driven 2-year yields up. It's, you know, oil's obviously driving inflation expectations higher in the Fed rate hike. So to me, I don't think that you can be underweight or short inflation. You should be long. Oil has been a big call of ours on the breakout since September. I say stay with that. You stay with any energy-related or oily-related security, and that would include countries like Russia. So again, that's why the market's making all-time highs every day, because tech and energy, or oil, however you want to look at it, continue to make a series of new 3-month highs, and that's, you know, that's bullish when it's happening at the same time.
What about all the bears out there, Keith, that say that the reason the market is up is purely because of QE? The economy is not doing nearly as good as people say it is, and we're just in this massive bubble. Where do you stand on that?
Well, everything you said up until the last thing is false. I mean, the economy's got, again, there's back-to-back GDPs with three handles. Now, if they preface what they said this year by saying, hey, you know what, Anthony, here's my call. GDP is going to be up in 3% back-to-back quarters, and tech earnings growth is going to be 26% growth year-over-year in the third quarter, and I'm still going to short this market because it's a bubble. Nobody said it that way. Of course they didn't. You know, so what you have is actually a lot of these, you know, a lot of these views of the bears have been debunked as false. The last thing you said on whether or not it's a bubble, I mean, you know, when a market hits new all-time highs every single day, I don't think that you can say it's not a bubble. I mean, it's the highest price we've ever seen.
Yeah.
But being bearish because you think it's a bubble means probably you missed it, or you don't own it, or something else. You know, to me, it doesn't really mean anything. This is the third, I guess, price bubble I've seen in my career, 1999, 2000, 2007, 2008. And fortunately for me, like, I'm not one of these guys that missed calling any of the bear markets yet. And that's really, I'm not saying that I'm not going to get wiped out this time. It's that I do have a track record of not missing a topping process. But at the same time, I don't see a topping process. I mean, we just saw the all-time closing high in the S&P, Russell, and NASDAQ on Friday. So clearly that wouldn't have been a good place to start calling it yet. But when we make that call, I think I have some chops in making that clear. And I just don't see it yet.
What would make you bearish the market?
The data, that damn data. it's not some magical multiple of the market. It's that the data slows. You know, the data didn't slow last week. It got faster. You know, that's the whole point, is that the data continues to accelerate. Whether you look at earnings growth, as I pointed out, in technology, that's the best quarter we've seen of the entire cycle. And that's the best part of the market to be in. So, again, if you want to be a real growth investor, you buy high growth stocks. The more expensive stocks have outperformed the less expensive stocks, by the way. So that, you know, it wouldn't be anything other than the data combined with some kind of a market signal. And again, the recent breakout in oil was a bullish signal, not a bearish signal. If oil were to go back to 30 and the S&P 500 would break, you know, at least break something like 25, 21, which to me is an important level, but it's a ways away from where we are now. You know, something. I just don't see any of it yet.
Yeah. Now, you also mentioned a lot that valuation is not a catalyst. Explain that.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's a theory. I mean, it's not. I mean, I've tried it too. I mean, I'm sure. Well, I shouldn't say. I can't speak for you, Anthony, but I've seen a lot of people who've, you know, deteriorated their returns or lost a lot of money trying to call tops on valuation. You could have called the stock market expensive in 1996, 97, 98, 99. By the time it's 99, you're out. You're out probably by 97, by the way. So markets don't stop getting more expensive just by force of its multiple. Markets start to see multiple compression or start to get cheaper when the causal factors that drove those markets higher, in this case, growth, profit growth and GDP growth, start to slow and roll over. So, yeah, that's just, I think it's a one-liner that catches people's attention, but I think it certainly differentiates the view that I've had this year versus a lot of people who start with this can't go on because it's expensive.
What do you think about passive investing and how that's really taken hold? It's such a big topic lately. I mean, you see so many blogs and people talking about it. Where do you stand on passive investing?
I love it. I love passive. I love aggressive. That's like my Twitter ad. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, what, you know, this manifestation of passive and the asset, you know, the asset allocation to passive for guys like us, I mean, that like to make shorter term trading calls or shorter term market calls. All it does is it makes things happen a little faster in a shorter, you know, time horizon. And, you know, that's what I like to see, is clusters of volatility or clusters of things that you can take advantage of. And I think that passive, you know, the aggrandizement, I guess, of the passive investing world has certainly helped those things happen a little faster. So I like it.
A lot of talk also about the yield curves flattening. I mean, I know I watch this a lot myself. I watch the 210 and I watch the 530. And really, we've almost seen no reaction in equities with a flattening of a yield curve. What do you think about that?
Well, we've seen a reaction. We've seen new all-time highs as a result.
Yeah, that's true. You're right about that.
The real flattening, guys, should be talking about is the flattening of the returns associated with shorting the NASDAQ on a concern of the flattening of the yield curve. Okay. I'm not saying that it doesn't entirely matter. It's the one thing. I call it macro tourism. Now everyone who doesn't have a process to do macro, they're going to talk about this one very lively macro tourist event called the flattening of the yield curve. By the way, the yield curve flattened because the two-year yield went up 50 basis points in 3 months on an oil move of about 18%. So, I mean, that's why the curve flattened. It didn't flatten because the long end of the curve collapsed. And again, it's probably means the Fed is one and done in raising rates, and that's pretty much it. Like, I don't see, like, even if you study market history, even recent market history, I mean, the Japanese yield curve, for God's sakes, is 21 basis points wide on 10s, 2s. 21. Now, what if you shorted the Nikkei all year long on that? I mean, that would be not a very bright move. I mean, you'd be down about 18% on that trade alone. So it's a thing that's happening, but I think I know why it's happening. Again, the 50 basis point move in 2s is a real thing that's happened here, and that happened because we had a big reflation in the oil price.
How would you look at the market if the 210 or the 530 yield curves got inverted?
Well, it's more on your way to inversion that's combined with growth slowing data. That's called a recession. I mean, it predicts a recession.
Exactly. But
you'd have to have that. So this is why people pay attention to it. But it's also measuring and mapping where it goes from. What I love about this now is that everyone's talking about it. Now what happens if the Fed is one and done? Because we have inflation, by the way, our call in 2018 for the first quarter is that inflation rolls over again. Now, if you made that call like we did at the end of March, you're going to see bond yields come down a lot, and particularly the two-year yield. So you could get, you could easily see a steepening of the curve. Boom, the two-year yield goes from 176 to one. It wouldn't take much to get it to 150 or 155. And that there you are. Now you got this re-steepening of the curve. But really, I don't think the market is trading on that. In as much as a lot of people got scared about the move in high yield 2 weeks ago, that was a head fake. You should have taken advantage of that. The high yield is in a bull market. The bonds are, yields are in a bear market. But you get these 2 week moves in that, or you get this compression in the yield spread. Macro tourists want to be there. They seem to be there in droves.
I want to go back to you using both fundamental and technical analysis. And with the new year coming up, what are some things that you'll be looking for a possible catalyst for a trade?
Well, I'm big on trying to find a regime change or what we call a phase transition, particularly in trends. So trends 3 months or more, that's what I really care about. But whether it be data or signal driven, so data, fundamental research data, I think the most likely one to change direction, like I said, is reflation rolling over, or inflation rolling over, reflation rolling over. We call it reflation's rollover. And you got to have some alliteration for people to pay attention on Twitter. But the reality is that that one looks more likely than anything to me. And the other big one is the trend is no longer your friend in either Chinese growth or European growth, particularly Southern European growth. So again, these are macro research trends that have already turned. So what we call old China. And it's kind of interesting. The Shanghai Composite Index has not had a lot of people talking about it. I guess it's the holiday week. But, it's down about 3% in the last month. That looks nothing like the NASDAQ. And we do see that runs in conjunction with the Chinese data slowing. So that's really back to my approach. I mean, I'm looking at the data at the same time as I'm looking at the signal. And while the signal in Chinese equities or any equity market, by the way, isn't always reflecting the economy, it is interesting to see that developing because that's one of the calls that we have for the first part of 2018 is China slowing. And like I said, the south of Europe, in particular, Italy, Spain, Portugal slowing.
Final question before we get into rapid fire, Keith. We talked about you using some technical analysis. Give me your favorite tool for technicals.
I publish it every day, and it's called the Daily Trading Range. product. So that to me is, that's my batter's box. So that's got the top end of the range and the low end of the range. Like I said, I want to be buying and covering at the low end of the range. I want to be selling and shorting things at the top end of the range. I actually made more short calls this year while being a bull. I think a pretty overt bull at that. I think I've had more sell or short calls this year. So, you know, you can use the whole point is to use that tool to improve your batting average. Now, slugging percentage obviously matters, but if you have a high batting average, it matters too. And that's what I like to do. I refuse to chase markets high and to capitulate and be the monkey selling them lower. That's just not what my process is set up to do, but that's the most important tool that I have to keep me on the right side of that.
It's amazing how something as simple as ranges can keep you from buying highs and selling lows, right? Just from looking at something, right? I mean, it just is something that simple. When you look at it and it's right there in front of you, unless you're trading for a breakout and it gets above a high or, you know, selling below a low, you have this great perspective of a range and you're going, here's the top part of the range, here's the bottom part of the range. What do you want to do? Yeah.
Yeah, that took me, I mean, to your point, man, that took me forever to not understand it, but to implement it in my process, like you said, and actually have the discipline to execute on it. Because your emotion will take you away from that very simple tool all of the time. You're always going to, you know, be fearful to make that sale at the top end of the range. You're going to feel it in your gut. If you're feeling something at the low end of the range, you're not going to want to buy. And it took me a long time to be able to do what, you know, if I used the rocks in my head and what's in my stomach, I'd be in a lot of trouble.
The hardest thing to do in this business is what you know is the right thing.
Exactly.
All right, Keith, we have some rapid fire questions, so I'm going to jump into those. All right, everyone, our rapid fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Trade the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. Create your account and try it now free at tryttnow.com. First question, Keith, what trader has influenced your life the most and why?
Oh, geez, that's a tough one. I would have to say Jesse Livermore. I don't even know if he's real. It's just the first book I ever read about trading, and it's anytime I want to relearn what I need to relearn or refocus on, it's got a lot of truth.
How has your trading evolved over the years?
Oh, it's become much more rules-based, and any day that I have an opportunity to remove emotion and complement my rules with better and better data, that's certainly been the point. Enrich better data with discipline and process.
What's the number one resource you spend your time on?
Market data, last price.
What's your favorite book about trading or the markets?
The Misbehavior of Markets by Benoit Mandelbrot.
What's your favorite movie or TV show about trading or the markets?
Braveheart.
What's the best piece of advice that you've received about trading or the markets?
Don't act on your emotion.
Now, if you can give a piece of advice to the new people interested in getting involved in trading, what would it be?
Start with not losing money. If you can mitigate those losses and let your winners run, that's the way that you can go on a good run and go on many good runs.
Now, if you weren't involved with the markets, you'd be doing what?
Coaching hockey.
Of course you would be. Who wouldn't be? I'd be a professional golfer, though, right now. I can tell you that.
Well, I wouldn't be playing hockey because I'm in my 40s. It would be ugly.
Keith, where could you, we talked about Twitter. Where could people find you on Twitter?
At Keith McCullough. It's just my name. That's my handle.
Now, talk to us about a website where people can learn more about you and HedgeEye.
That's just HedgeEye.com. So that's where we have all of our tools. Again, we try to make a lot of these tools like the daily trading ranges or the early look note, which is a strategy note, or our macro show, which I do every morning at 9. That's a live broadcast of what I think the market's going to do across everything, currencies, fully loaded commodities, equity markets, obviously. It's an around-the-world look. It's like 20 minutes, 20, 30 minutes if I'm ranting every morning, and that's we have a subscription for that too.
Yeah, no, I definitely recommend checking out everything that Keith mentioned, especially check him out on Twitter. Keith is always open to a good conversation on Twitter, and so I definitely recommend everyone checking out Keith. Keith, thank you again so much for coming on Futures Radio Show.
Thanks. It's a great show. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com. and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.